this year is Yosef's Economy and Mordechai's Army, The Business Ethics of Insider Information. So what does this all mean? Well, we're going to unpack that in the shiur. Here's the general outline of what we're going to do. First, we're going to discuss the general idea in business ethics called insider information. We're going to see how this relates to Yosef's story when he becomes the vizier of Egypt. An interesting parallel to Megillat Esther, because Purim's around the corner. And finally, a counterpoint to everything I'm going to be talking about, which is the value of privacy in Judaism. Any questions? All right, let's get started. So please turn to the next page, to page two. So what is insider information? Good question. Well, before we talk about exactly what insider information is, we need to understand this is an issue, first and foremost, about business ethics, how we should conduct ourselves when we're in a business environment. So for that, we're going to start with the Ramban on Shmot Chaf Aleph Aleph, Ve'ilah HaMishpatim. Tam, Ve'ilah HaMishpatim, Asher Tassim Lifneihem, Ki Ratzah Lahaktim Lahem HaMishpatim, Ki Kasher Haya Ba'asar HaDibrot HaDibur HaRishon B'Yidiyat Hashem, Ve'ashini B'Yisur Avodah Zarah, Chazar V'tziva Et Moshe Kotamar Al B'nei Yisrael, Atem Re'item, Ki Min HaShemayim Dibartim Achem Ayil, She tizharim ata od shiitim liban lemasher uvizharim mitzvot ha'ilut tshivitim ki atam reitam kineged dibor anochi v'lo tasunoti kineged lo liyavacha le'ashim le'inyan avodah zarah. So what's the Ramban saying up until now? That he's doing basic pshuto shel mikra, and he's noting how earlier on in the Sefer we have the giving of Matan Torah with the giving of the Asar HaDibrot as well, and saying how each one of the dibrot correlates to psukim which follow it as a kind of a buffer, and saying that when we have the tzivui of Anochi Hashem, Hashem explains that you should also then not have any other gods besides for me, as a way to make sure that you're going to keep these laws. So what's going to happen? Where's he going with this? Here's the bold part. Ve'ela mishpatim keneged lo tachmod. So what's the korah for Elam Mashpatim? Really, the tzivui in the Atzeret HaTibrot of lo tachmod, you should not covet, is to correlate to what's happening in the parsha of Elam Mashpatim, that the laws of how you shouldn't covet are explained in the buffer laws in the parsha of Elam Mashpatim. And it's necessary because once you desire someone else's house or their wife or whatever, you might come and take it for yourself. And so the laws in Elam Mishpatim about how to conduct yourself when with other slaves or other things of property are all telling you what you should do in a business transaction so you don't come to ultimately covet something that's not actually yours. Lefichach amar tasim lifnehem. Here's the underline and the important part. Mishpatim yisharim yanhigu otan b'neihem. The ultimate idea, the essence of what's being commanded here, b'ela mishpatim, and rooting all the way back to the Asar HaDibrot, is that you should have good laws, ethical laws, that should be conducted between you and other, and between you and your fellow. What's the Ramban telling you? That the idea of business ethics is inherent in the Asar HaDibrot and the motivation behind our laws. When we think about the laws of Judaism, sometimes we can think that we're taught it's only about the rituals that happens in Shul or stuff that relates to Orach Chaim. What's the Ramban telling you here? Even in your business transactions, you must be ethical. That is such an important idea. So that's the reason I mention this is because sometimes when we frame things in the terms of business ethics, you might think, oh, business ethics, that's a secular thing. But what we see with the Ramban here is that the two are parallel ideas which coalesce. Business ethics are so important, and it is inherently a Jewish idea as well. So this year is going to be delving into one business ethic about insider information. So what's insider information? So if we go to the next source with Dr. Moses Pava, Business Ethics, A Jewish Perspective, he says, inside information as an economic concept grew out of the innovative but simple idea that information, like physical assets, is a scarce economic resource. Indeed, economists have suggested that in reality, information is spotty, biased, and very costly to attain, we define inside information in very general terms as information asymmetry. So what is insider information? The idea that you know something and someone else doesn't. I know something, you do not know, and that gives me power. So in business deals, it can be come out in very obvious ways, right? Let's say you're the CEO of a company, someone else is a shareholder. You as a CEO know there's going to be a merger, the shareholders don't. So that could really offset what the shareholder might do with his money, given that he doesn't know what the CEO knows. Or if you go like at the Martha Stewart example, right? She knows what's going to happen to the stocks, so she sells them. She has insider information. But is that ethical? No. Because just because she has that insider information, no one else has it. Had everyone else known what Martha Stewart knew, they also would have done what she did. That wasn't fair. So, I mean, in business ethics, it comes out in very obvious ways. But what I'm going to argue here is this idea of business ethics has a very important relationship to what happens in Tanakh and our biblical stories. I'll just give one example to communicate the point, and then we'll see how it relates to the Yosef story. Take the story of Abraham and Sarah. They go down to Egypt. And what do they say? Achutihi. She's my sister. But what's Sarah really? Is Sarah actually his sister? No, that's not true. Sarah and Abraham are married. That's information asymmetry right there. Abraham and Sarah know the real truth about their relationship, but they intentionally lie for whatever reason. But the whole point is that it's all based on the information asymmetry. And should Paro feel slighted? Yeah, I get where he's coming from. He was told a lie. They are siblings. They actually are married. Aw. So how can we apply this idea of information asymmetry to the Yosef story? Well, think about relationships. Yosef is the vizier. He's the second in command. But how does he act to the brother, his brothers? As just a vizier. They have no idea that Yosef is Yosef. They think he's just some guy, some hotshot who's running the show. Whereas Yosef knows the truth. That's information asymmetry right there in respect to his relationship. And in fact, what's happening in the story of Breishit is, so when's Yosef going to rat himself out? When's it all going to be known that Yosef is really related to the brothers? We, as the readers, know the whole time that Yosef is related to the brothers. But for the brothers, that's information asymmetry. They have no idea who they're really talking to. So is everyone understanding how the idea of information asymmetries can have like real ramifications to the way people act in real life? Yeah.
I mean, I think like it might be helpful to unpack the concept a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So because it can't always be unethical if you're wondering that information.
Ah. So you bring up the issue of fairness.
No, I mean, I'm not simply bringing up the issue of fairness.
To expand
the trade secret, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, trade secrets. I don't think that information that it's certainly like it's not recognized as unethical.
Mm-hmm.
For one party to have information that the other doesn't. In that case, you could identify that as information asymmetry if you wish to do so. But I think that calling any instance where one party has more information than the other, and even in dealings with the other, is I think maybe we have to define it, sharpen our terms a little more before we blanket state information asymmetry.
To clarify, I'm not necessarily saying that information asymmetry is always bad. I think there are times when actually it's very important that other people do not know the whole truth. I'll give an example, which I know is kind of a, you know, might be a bit, I might be like stepping on some people's nerves here, but if someone that's, for example, is homosexual in the Orthodox community, I can definitely understand why they would want to keep that information in asymmetry. I can definitely understand why someone would want to keep that private, because the consequences of sharing that could be really detrimental. It could be extremely detrimental for their entire reputation. And so ultimately, many people do come out of the closet. But and the thing is, afterwards, people ask, oh, you lied to me that you didn't tell me before. Yes, it's an information asymmetry, but I understand why homosexuals in the Orthodox community keep their orientation silent for some time. So the point is that, ethically speaking, is it always unethical? That's a reasonable question to ask. And if you want to read more, if you look at the third source on the page from Jennifer Moore, her entire article deals with why information asymmetry is actually ethical. So you can get more information on that.
Okay.
at a later point, so let's take two more questions, then I want to go on to the other part.
So,
yeah. Right, I think what you're mentioning here is actually a very good point to exonerate Avraham and Sarah at this point, because even though it's an asymmetry, and even though Paro has good reason to get upset, because like, oh, you lied to me, they also had a very good reason to lie. When your life is on the line, and you're worried that someone's going to kill you and or your wife, I can totally understand why someone would have to say, achotihi. That makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, your point is very well taken, and you and Danny should, you know, have something going on here, because you're both basically referencing how information asymmetry isn't always a bad thing and actually has a lot of functionality. So that is point well taken. But now, so we already know how it relates to the Yosef story insofar as his identity is hidden from the brothers. Ultimately, he reveals it. But what I'm going to argue here is that in the perek where Yosef explains the dreams to Paro and suggests to Paro a model for how to help the Mitzrayim get through the famine, that there's information asymmetry between the plan and the Egyptian people. That is my main argument here. My main argument is that in understanding what Yosef tells Paro, that stuff is being kept from the Egyptian people and how it has consequences for what actually happens during the famine. That's my main point, and we're going to now unpack that. So where are we in the story? Yosef is... He's in jail, and he sees the butler and the baker. They seem really sad, and he explains their dreams. But the butler, despite being freed, forgets to tell Paro about Yosef for whatever reason. Though when Paro has two very scary dreams about seven fat cows and seven skinny cows, the butler says, I remember my sins today, and yes, et chatati ani maskir hayom. Yosef gets himself cleaned up, and he goes to Pharaoh to explain his dreams. So that brings us to Bereishit Perek Mem Aleph, Pasuk Chaf Tet. So here's the explanations of the dreams. Hine, Sheva Shanim Ba'ot Sheva Gadol, B'chol Eretz Mitzrayim. There are seven big years coming for the land of Egypt. V'kamu Sheva Shnei Ra'a V'chorehen, V'nishkach Chol HaSav'a Be'eretz Mitzrayim. And afterwards, there'll be 7 years of famine, and everyone will forget all the plenty in the land of Egypt. And the famine will make the land desolate. Emphasizing again that this is going to be a really tough famine. And the fact that each dream happened very quickly, one after the other, indicates that these are basically imminent. And now Pharaoh sees a wise and knowledgeable man, appoint a wise and knowledgeable land over the land of Egypt. And it should be done for Pharaoh that there should be men appointed in the kingdom. And he should split the land into a fifth during the years of plenty. And you should gather all the food from the 7 years of plenty, and it should be gathered under Pharaoh's hands. And they should be guarded in cities. And basically, this is a solution. By having all the food gathered in these cities for 7 years, during the years of famine, everyone will have something to eat. How does Paro respond? Now we're in Pasuk Lamed Zayin. Vayitav hadavar be'enei paro v'enei kol avadav. Paro and his servants like the idea. Smart dude. Got a solution. We have crisis incoming. He has a solution. Let's go with it. Ve'yomer paro avadav. Hanimsach hazayish asher ruach elokim bo. Is there a man like this where the spirit of God is within him? Ve'yomer paro al Yosef. Acharei hodia elokim otcha et kol zot. Yosef, you said that we should find someone really smart to put over the land of Egypt. Well, you seem like a really good guy. You should be that guy. And you should be forever my house. And on your mouth, you'll feed my nation. Only the throne will be higher than you. So what's happened thus far? Yosef comes initially just to help Paro because of his dreams, given his interpretation and understanding that there will be an impending famine. Yosef says, I got a solution. And what happens? Paro likes it. And even better, because Yosef showed his intellectual prowess, Paro said, I want you to be in charge. I trust you. And I think you'll do the job well. And so as we know, Yosef, the Vana Hafochu, Yosef goes from being down in the pit, right, to now being second in command. And he goes with the chariot, and he has the king's signet ring and all that good jazz. But jumping to Pesach Nodhei, what happens actually when we hit the 7 years of famine? Batir Av Kol Eretz Mitzrayim. Vayitzak Ha'am El Paro Lalechem Vayomar Paro Lechol Mitzrayim. L'chu el Yosef asher yimru lechem tasu. What happens? It's amazing. The famine comes. Everyone's crying to Pharaoh for bread, which is obvious. And what does he do? Not my problem. You tacked the wrong department. It's not my issue. Talk to Yosef. It's his problem now. What we see here is actually something very evil. Very evil indeed. Pharaoh knew that if there's a crisis happening, like the crisis cannot be averted. Sure, you can try gathering grain and all that good jazz. You'll prepare yourself. But is that actually going to help during the years of famine? No! Because even in the years of famine, people are going to starve. When the pasuk says, Vayitav hadavar b'enei paro b'enei kol avadav, I think it's a very ironic line. Why does Paro think it's a good idea? It's very cynical. But Paro knows it's a good idea because he won't have to deal with it. When a king is in charge of his people and he's responsible for dealing with crises, and he's essentially saying, someone else will deal with my problems, why is it good for him? Because he's lazy. Paro doesn't want to have to deal with the consequences of being a leader. Paro doesn't want to have to deal with the fact that there's a crisis happening, and if someone else is willing to take the brunt of the blow for it, great. So what we initially thought was like really, yay, v'nahafochu. Isn't it great that Yosef is getting out of prison? I think Paro is just a very evil man. I think Paro intentionally did this in a very sly way to make sure that he wouldn't have to deal with the problem later on. I see there are some hands. So let's just take two questions.
Yes. I don't know exactly what would be a good retort against that, because I haven't planned it as well as you have. But it sounds like if Power really wanted to escape the role of having to deal with this situation and this crisis, then he would have said that Yosef is the interim Paro. Mm. They would have established him as a temporary Paro. I'm still the king, but he's in charge of everything. Instead of that, he just appoints him underneath Paro. So he still has to
hold that thought. Hold that thought because you're onto something. You're onto something in respect to Yosef being the public one and taking the brunt of it. Hold that thought because it's going to be relevant in like 15 minutes. Okay. Yeah.
I'm not sure why a leader doing delegation so that a problem gets solved, but he or she would know the problem best and know how to solve it best. I don't see why that's faulty leadership. And even
So you mentioned two very good points. The first one I definitely hear. I think touche, in that I do understand why it does make sense to delegate. I hear that. As a leader myself, I know that delegation is important. So I hear that point well taken. In respect to Yosef doing something that isn't going to work, so that's actually a very troubling idea to suggest. I mean, I think you're hitting on something which is very important, in that if this really has negative consequences, then I've just basically implicated Yosef for having a bad idea, right? So how do we deal with that? So I think, personally speaking, we think of Yosef as being Yosef HaTzadik for a number of reasons, and I'm inclined to think that Yosef did not have negative intentions, though, as we'll see, even with when people have negative intentions, sometimes things don't work out. Just to make one more point, and then I'll take Blanche's comments, I just want to note that there were actually many options Yosef could have suggested, right? There are many different models of government, and there are many different models for what people can do in a time of crisis. What Yosef essentially did was he said, during the years of plenty, we'll collect, and during the years of famine, we'll distribute, right? But there are other models. You could have like a laissez-faire model where every single person figures out on their own, and they just buy and trade. What? It could have been a possibility.
Yeah, but Egypt wouldn't have done that.
Well, so
top of the government.
No, but Paro himself wouldn't have done that. He would never allow for that. He himself, or he is in charge. First of all, this man is like literally thinks he's a god. Second of all, he like is in charge of everyone that's in and out of the country. So like he never would give over. And there's a precedent for people coming to the mountains trying to get food.
Mm-hmm.
So like it's not so ridiculous to.
But even if there wasn't,
I mean, far-fetched.
Even if there isn't necessarily a laissez-faire government where everyone can kind of figure it out on their own, there's also like a mixed economy where, you know, the government takes care of some, people take care of some. I mean, what basically happened here was full governmental control, and the government basically saying, we know that there's a crisis happening, we're preparing for it, and we'll deal with it. When I say government, we really mean Yosef. But, okay, we're going to take your sweep, and then we really have to move forward. Okay, so, yeah.
Are you saying that the information asymmetry is
So you're asking, what is the insider information here as it pertains to the story? That's a very good question. So I was going to mention that afterwards, but now that
you
asked.
You can mention it.
Like, they all look at each other.
So what's the insider information? Well, here's what I think. How could it, let's take a closer look at Pasuk Nun Hei. That's your Av Kol Eretz Mitzrayim. The famine was in the entire land of Egypt. Vayitzak ha'am el paro lalechem. The entire nation asks Pharaoh for food. Vayomar paro l'chol Mitzrayim l'chol Yosef. Paro tells the entire land of Egypt, go to Yosef, asher yomar lachem ta'asu. So he'll tell you what to do. So what's the implication? Why did they go to Pharaoh first? Why is it that Yosef has been in this position for 7 good years? He's even portioned off a part of the land of Egypt. And he's portioned off a part of the land of Egypt. And you're telling me the entire people of Mitzrayim have no idea who Yosef is? Okay. Welcome, Bracha. Okay, I'll repeat that point because it looks like everyone was like a little distracted there. No, it's good. This is my sister Bracha, by the way. Hi, guys. Okay. It's good stuff. I'll repeat the point. How could it be that Yosef is in this position of second in command for 7 years, he's collecting grain, and suddenly when a famine hits, no one knows who the heck he is? That's just not possible. And so what I think is happening here is an information asymmetry, in that Yosef, Pharaoh's servants, and Pharaoh himself knew that there was an incoming famine. And they portioned off the land of Egypt, and they got their grain. And that was great. But did the land of Egypt know? Did they prepare? Did they have their own personal storehouses?
And so
I'm saying the information asymmetry here is that the government knows a secret, the people don't. And so what I'm saying here is there's this lack of transparency where it's actually unclear whether the nation knew that this was going to happen or not. Just because Pharaoh knew doesn't mean the people were aware.
And that just sort of
Right.
It's not necessarily like a government like the U.S. that has transparency. It's a dictatorship. It's a religious dictatorship.
But I don't know about Yosef being a tzaddik. Yosef is half tzaddik. Is that concept of like Yosef being? I mean, he's the only one that's called a tzaddik, but he's the only one. He gets that epithet at the end of his life, like mm-hmm. really in Perek Nun, mm-hmm. like he doesn't mm-hmm. earn it until then. I think mm-hmm. I would argue. The Hatzadik, like he's the only one who
judges
all that, right?
I think there's several reasons why he could be called Yosef Hatzadik, in that
was
actually.
God was with him.
Right, I mean, you could say that stuff with Ishi Potifar, stuff that happens with him in the jail.
I would say even then, up until Perek Nun in Bereishit, like maybe Mentet, maybe Yosef does not earn that title, that epithet, I would say. I would argue.
He's not like a bad guy.
No, he's not a bad guy, but the things that he does, it's.
Have you seen
I just want to take like these last 3 points and then so what was your question though? But I just want to take these like last 3 questions, and I really need to move forward. So, wait, what was your question? Oh, okay, so Alana.
Can we say that maybe that if Pharaoh was being so evil, why did he take it as his own idea? Like, why wouldn't he just take it as his own idea? And if it seems like such a great idea, of like, oh, I'm going
to
save the people.
Hold that thought. That's a very good point, but I need you to hold that thought because it's relevant in like 5 minutes. Okay, Shoshana.
I mean, I don't know if you're going to talk.
So, again, I'm going to speak to that in, like, 2 seconds. Okay, last question, and then we have to move forward.
Okay, so you brought up the point that how do, like, people now know who Yosef was, mm-hmm. and he, like, kind of, it's possible that he put himself in charge as a way of getting himself in power at the mm-hmm. point. So I guess my response to that would be that they can't necessarily trust the people to be responsible. Like, we have mm-hmm. social security because mm-hmm. people aren't responsible enough to plan for retirement. So, even if they had known that the family was coming in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point in that sometimes when we set up models for government or different rules in government, sometimes it's intentionally paternalistic. And I understand that. And so there, what I'm saying is that there could be positive functions, whether it be to the information asymmetries or to the idea that maybe Paro didn't want to tell his people. You know, hypothetically, Paro didn't want to tell his people because he didn't want his nation to freak out. Because wouldn't it be kind of scary if someone told you that there'd be a famine for 7 years? Yeah, I get that. So, last, but Beitzer, moving forward, we're now on to page 3.
Right.
Now to turn the page. So we're now, so just to regroup now. So now Yosef has interpreted the dreams. He's now second in command. The famine has started, and Paro has abdicated all responsibility, given it to Yosef. Now let's see how Yosef's plan works. Does it work? Does it not work? Let's see. So now we're in Bereishit Mem Zayin. We're starting with Pasuk Yud-Gimel. So, V'lechem ein b'chol ha'aretz, ki chavir ha'ra'av me'od, v'teila ha'aretz Mitzrayim ve'aretz Kanan mipnei ha'ra'av. There's no bread anywhere, not in Egypt, not in Canaan. Yalkei Yosef et kol ha-kesef. Ha-kesef. Ha-nimsa ve'aretz Yitzrayim ve'aretz Kanan. Ve'shever ha-sher ha-mishovrim. Ve'yavei Yosef et ha-kesef beit ha-paro. So what happens? Paro gets all the liquid assets of Kanan and Yitzrayim so that people can live and get grain. Ve'yitom ha-kesef me'aretz Yitzrayim ume'aretz Kanan. Ve'yavei kol Yitzrayim al Yosef le'emor. Havei lanu lechem, v'lamana negdacha, ki efes kesef. It's chilling. Money is nothing when our lives are at stake. Our money has no value left if we need to give it. We need to give our money away because it's almost valueless in comparison to the value of our lives. But they've run out. They have no money left. Pasuk Tetzayin, Vayomer Yosef, Havu Miknechem, Betzna Lachem Miknechem Im Efes Kesef. Well, if your money has no value left, then bring your flock. Vayavu Kol Miknechem El Yosef, Vayitin Lachem Yosef Lachem Basusim Uvi Mikneh Hatzon Uvi Mikneh Bakar Uvi Chamarim, Vayin Alayim Vayachem Bechol Miknechem Bashana Hahi. And for a year, the people of Egypt brought all of their livestock, their donkeys, their sheep, their horses, whatever. It's more important to eat than to have your horse. Sometimes you gotta set your priorities straight. And that lasted for a year. Pasuk Yudchet. Vatitoma Shanahi. Vatitoma Shanahi. Ve'avoi elav v'shanah ha'shinit ve'yomeru lo. Nunachad me'adonai, amadoni. Kim tam ha'kesef mikneu behima al adoni. Lo nishar lifnei adoni. Vilti im givtenu v'ad matenu. Lama namu le'enacha. Gam anachnu gano natinu. Kneu otanu v'ad matenu v'alachem. V'nihiye anachnu v'ad matenu avadim lef paro. What happened? They run out and they're out of choices. What do they give up ultimately? They give up everything. They give up anachnu, ourselves. Ve'admatinu, our lands. What's happened? Because there was insufficient grain to feed the people of Egypt during the famine, they enslaved themselves. They gave over their land and they started to work it for Pharaoh. What's happened very rapidly is that this has become a totalitarian dictatorship in a way. Paro owns everything. He owns all the liquid assets. He owns all the livestock. He out now owns his own people. And what's chilling about this is that we realize that Yosef is the one who's going to get the brunt of the blame for this, not Paro, which is what you guys were kind of hinting to right now. Yosef was in the public eye. Yosef was the one who was giving out the grain. What's going to happen? Blame it on the Jew. Blame it on Yosef. Because Yosef was the one who was distributing it, so everyone thinks, oh, his idea. Now that we're enslaved, we know who to point the finger at. Why should they think it's at Paro's fault? But Yosef is just as Paro's representative. Yosef had an idea, which many of you have referenced actually had some promise to it. Maybe there actually really could be excellent reasons why Yosef had this plan. But did it work? If it leads to the enslavement of people, did it work? What we realize from here is that what happened just in these few psukim is very important for us to know. You know, usually the Tanakh tells the story of the Jewish people. We hear what happens to Abraham's children and ultimately Bnei Israel. And we're not usually so concerned with what happens to non-Jewish people, right? And yeah, it involves Yosef, but why do we care about this? Why do we need to know that what happened with Yosef is that he accidentally caused the enslavement of Egyptian people? Because a country which is accepting of dehumanizing their own citizens to enslave them will ultimately enslave someone else. Because if Yosef is going to enslave the people of Egypt, it ain't all that shocking that what we see what happens in Sefer Shemot. In Sefer Shemot, we have the enslavement of our own people, the Jewish people. And it wasn't any kind of enslavement, it was Avodah Parech. What kind of work is Avodah Parech? Useless work. Useless, absolutely useless work. You know, there's a midrash that Paro and Sefer Shemot had the women doing men's job and women doing men doing women's jobs, whatever. I don't really know about gender distinctions with work. What does that mean? It wasn't about productivity. If it was all about productivity, then he would just have women doing women's jobs and men doing men's jobs. The whole point was to communicate to the Jewish people, you're nothing. That's what Avodah Parech is. It's baseless dehumanization. And so unintentionally what has occurred is that Paro very sneakily has used Yosef as a means to be the owner of everything in the land of Egypt, including the people. And the consequence, I think, is what we see in the story of Yetzia Mitzrayim. We're taking like two questions, and then we have to move forward. Yes.
I don't have actually a question, but it actually makes a lot of sense. The fact that, according to one of the midrashim, it says "Ve'akam Melchav Shishol Yodas Yosef," that you might not be thinking the same thing, but I get the nod. Joining me on with the fact that Paro is so paranoid about somebody else taking over his own leadership. Mm-hmm. It might be the same king who. It actually works in historical context that he riles up his own people because he basically owns the people now. So they all throw a coup d'etat and overthrow his own.
That's a very clever reading. I like that. It's very clever.
Yeah, so it makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
We'll take these two comments and then we really have to move forward. Okay.
Just because you brought it up, I'm inclined to think that a more simple reading of Asher Lo Yada'a of Yosef makes us think that actually the enslavement has absolutely nothing to do with Yosef. In fact, there's a contradistinction to the Jews' assistance to the Egyptian people in the time of need, and it would actually undermine the idea. But I do think that, I would be inclined to blame the Jew, but my anti-Semitic inclinations aside, I don't like. Does it happen in the text? Do you think, do you have any, maybe textual evidence for this?
That what?
That, the enslavement, Paro in Shmot, enslaved Jewish people as a response to Yosef.
I don't know necessarily about a response to Yosef, but I think it's part of it's a cultural climate. I think it sets a precedent. And when you have a precedent and a cultural climate for something, it leads to acceptance of that thing. So do I have any, specific textual proof to say, oh, Paro was specifically. How do we understand Lo Yada'at Yosef? That's really debatable. But I think it sets a cultural precedent where people in Egypt are throw babies in the Nile, or enslaving people, great. because it comes with a certain cultural norm of thinking people aren't really people. I mean, because that's what slavery is. So I mean, I think that precedent was unfortunately started with this.
And once again, Yosef comes out as the bad guy who actually installed the precedent.
But the ironic thing is that if Yosef wasn't there. Who would be doing this instead? It would either have been Pharaoh or someone else.
But they would
probably
maybe.
So actually, what you're hitting on, Shoshana, is actually what you're hitting on is actually a pro. You know, we're thinking right now, we're kind of framing this in very grave terms of oh my God, how could this be? Enslavement of a people? Crazy. That's a bad thing. But maybe there are actually some good things that happen from this. So first of all, the people survive. You know, I mean, it's really crummy that they wind up in the situation of enslavement, but hey, they're alive. And they themselves say, why should I care about stuff if I can be alive? So being alive, yeah, that's a good thing. Another good thing is that because of this famine, Yosef's brothers go down to Egypt. So if this famine never happened, and if it never got this bad, you know, but the brothers have ever reunited? I don't know. So, I mean, that's another pro. I mean, there are really grave consequences, and I'm not trying to, belittle them in any way, but there are some good things that happened because of Yosef's leadership. Okay, last comment, and then we have to move forward.
I mean, so the reading that Yosef sort of takes the blame, is the bad guy, that is challenged by the reaction. As a Nishin, in other words, I don't know that the Egyptians. I mean, presumably,
that's a good point.
I think that a more compelling, the different reading as a whole might indicate that the people of Egypt recognized that the natural disaster, who recognized that Yosef had been gathering grain from them for 7 years, which presumably. Mm-hmm. And then he dies
and mourned for him. Right. No, I that's a good point. I didn't think of that before, but that's a good point. That maybe, maybe they weren't as so disrespectful of him. And then, very last comment.
Just to support Danny's comment.
Do you mind shutting off the heat? Because I'm
We tried.
Okay.
I forgot my point.
Danny.
No.
Yosef Sag.
Yes, I guess. No, we have the energy of the same reading. For the entire, not the entire, but yes, for the entire Yosef story, I would argue that he's like 10 steps ahead of everyone. And everyone's like, oh, God is with you. Yekev Abba is with you. Oh my gosh, you must be like the man of God. Ish Matzliach. Like, because he plans out everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how, I mean, for this man to like get up in front of Paro and be like, and while you're at it, you know, hire someone who's Nisha Bon Vechacham, and for him not to know what might happen, to him not to know the implications of his plan.
Mm.
I don't know. I think
hear what you're saying.
Of, like, implicating
right.
Yosef, how can we implicate Yosef? I think you need to implicate Yosef. Like Shoshana said, if Yosef wasn't there, the tribe would have been enslaved. Yes, they would have died. But they wouldn't have been enslaved. Maybe they would have died. I don't know. but they definitely would have been enslaved. And that's definitely, again, setting the stage for my tribe being this country that's like, no, we're going to enslave people because we value Kezef over you.
Right.
That was the support.
Wait, so how could Yosef not do that? I hear that.
Right.
Alright, very last point, and then we really have to move forward.
It seems to me like Yosef planned this entire thing. He knew that he was going to end up enslaving the entire people, and he did this on purpose. And Paro loved this idea because it allowed him to take control of the entire country, and at the same time, nobody minded because they knew it was saving their lives. So it was like win-win-win for Yosef.
Mm.
He got to get all his power for Paro, causing his own power, and everybody loved him anyway.
So, I mean, I'll tell you, I think that my inclination, though, at the end of the day, with respect to can we exonerate Yosef in this, Yosef says himself in the Psukim, if you gather grain for 7 years, then we'll have enough during the years of famine. I think when Yosef's suggesting the plan, he actually has good intentions in mind. It's only Paro who's malicious. I mean, that's...
Paro didn't do anything. Yosef is the one who, he's the one who's charging them for it. Like, why is he making them pay for this food that he gathered from them? He, collected the food from them and then made them buy it back. And he knew that they weren't going to have enough money. He decided what the prices were. He decided that they were going to have to enslave themselves, which is all his.
So, moving forward to now the parallel to Megillat Esther, because Purim is coming up. The point that I wanted to make here is this. In Megillat Esther, you can make a connection where Paro is Ahasuerus and Yosef is Mordechai. Again, that Paro is Ahasuerus and Yosef is Mordechai. So there are many connections. I'll just name off a few for Yosef and Mordechai. Both of them are exiled from their homeland. They offer advice to the king, and then a message is sent out. They are drawn in a royal chariot with an announcement. They both become second in command because of a dream / a lack of sleep episode. Relating, and that dream somehow, the connection with the dream is about death or of a nation or assassination. Both of them are known as Jews. In terms of Paro and Ahasuerus, aside from them both being kings, I'm going to argue that both of them are the definition of evil. I know that in... I mean, listen, if you look at Masechet Megillah, Daf Yedbet Amud Aleph, there's a machloket between Rav and Shmuel. Rav Shmuel, Chad Amar Melech Pikei Chaya, V'chad Amar Melech Tipei Chaya. So one says that Ahasuerus was a genius, and the other one says he's a bumbling idiot. So we're going with the interpretation that Ahasuerus was a genius and was actually very crude and evil at that. Because if we can argue that Paro is evil, it shouldn't be too difficult to say that Ahasuerus was also evil. So what's the connection here? No, different ideas. Different arguments as to how to understand Ahasuerus.
Oh.
Either you can interpret him as being very, very, very smart, or you can interpret him as being really stupid. Two ways to interpret it. So, here's the example from Megillat Esther, and then I'll explain how it connects back to this Yosef story. So in Parak Chet, after Haman is hung on a tree, and, you know, yay, we think the Jews are winning because Esther is, getting Ahasuerus on the Jew side. It's great. So what happens, though? Esther asks Ahasuerus, revoke your earlier decree. You had this decree thing about, killing all the Jews. Remember that? Revoke it. What does Ahasuerus say? ki chata b'shem ha-melech v'nachtom b'tabat ha-melech in la-shiv. If it's written, I can't repeal it. Sorry. So is Ahasuerus is a very smart person or a very idiotic person at this time? Or maybe he's both.
This is a dumb comment. From him, I'm saying.
Okay, so the simple understanding is that that Ahasuerus...
You can override it.
Yeah, so...
If it's written down on your signature...
You're the king, you can override it. I don't know, this is exactly what being a king means. Of course, you have total power.
If you're melech over parasu madai, and you have, like, all the money in the world to, like, serve your entire kingdom, tons of food, of everything, I mean, and you're able to basically coordinate whatever you want, you're telling me that a king can't overturn a decree? Are you serious? Is Paro that, is Ahasuerus, excuse me, that much of an idiot?
It undermines his ability as king.
Yeah, I mean, it undermines his ability as king.
But contrary, for him to be able to override something is him affirming his power.
If he's viewed the king as divine, any decision he makes has to be, like, good. If I go back on a decision, that shows my previous decision was a bad decision.
That's you proving that you're king. You're affirming your authority
by
saying you are going to listen to me no matter what I say. Yes, I can flip my, I can change my mind in a minute.
Does your authority rest on you or rest on your status as divine being?
I don't think Ahasuerus thought he was a
I'm connecting what I know.
Okay, say your point, and then we're going to.
True.
I don't think you're right.
Okay.
I think he thought he was
the Persian Empire.
Divine, not divine. Okay.
I don't
right. Actually, can we just like bracket this for a second? Okay. So there are arguments as to why this Paro Ahasuerus could be seen as a bumbling moron here, because if he's king, he can override his rules, right? Okay. But why would Ahasuerus actually be a genius for saying this? This could actually be the most ingenious comment he could have ever said. Why? Let's think. Haman has an army growing. We know that from Perikim, well, certainly from Perikai. He has a bunch of people who really like him, who are all anti-Semites and ready to kill the Jews. Now, if Haman was like on Ahasuerus' side, that means that Ahasuerus has people within him that has these dual loyalties right now. He has people within his government who are ready to kill the Jews, and Ahasuerus already signed off on that. They're ready to kill the Jews, and he signed off. So what's he going to do? He has the day of Purim coming. Is army ready to kill the Jews? When he's supposed to say, no, sorry, I retract. He needs to get rid of this army of anti-Semites. Aw. So what does he say? Jews, you have the right to fight back. Read. I don't want to deal with this army. Fight and you might die, but I don't care. What does this mean? I mean, I was thinking about this over the summer, right? I was in Israel this past summer. I was doing research in Bar Ilan University, and I mean, it really hit me. There's really something to like having the right to back. But anyway, enough about my Israel politics. the point here is that Ahasuerus didn't want to deal with the problem. He didn't want to have to deal with the situation that he has a bunch of Hamanites who are ready to kill the Jews. So instead of dealing with them also, he said, all right, Jews, deal with it. Yeah, I'm giving you the right to fight back. Feel honored. Feel honored that I'm giving you the right to fight back. Because now that you have the right to fight back, you'll deal with all the people who I don't want to deal with. Is this idea clear? Yeah? So how does this connect to the Yosef story? How does this connect? That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. And that both Mordechai's army and Yosef's economy were unfortunate but necessary things to happen. Yosef had to have this economy, which in some, you could argue worked out, didn't work out, depending on which reading you like. But it ultimately did wind up in the enslavement of the Egyptian people, and Paro gets no blame for it. Yosef's the one who bears the brunt of that. Mordechai's army, is it the ideal? Are we in the Lechatchila land to have Mordechai, with Mordechai to have an army? No! But it was a problem that needed to be fixed. Ahasuerus didn't want to deal with Haman's army. So Mordechai, having his army of Jewish people to fight against Haman, was an unfortunate but necessary solution to fixing his political conundrum.
Wow.
Okay. So, pause. So, you know, how does this all relate to insider information, not insider information? What we see here is that potentially major political leaders can have motivations behind ideas. Like, let's say we take this reading of Ahasuerus needing to get rid of this Haman army situation. Then Ahasuerus has a lot of motivations and a lot of really serious things to question and to take into balance before he actually goes forward with his ideas. But he never clarifies his ideas. He just says, "V'nachtom b'tabat ha'melech in la'ashiv." He just says, "Whatever I sign, I can't retract." So, does that mean we should always be transparent? Does it always mean we should tell our ideas to other people? Should we always be brutally honest? So, I mean, towards about it, in the last section, the counterpoint, there are cases where we're told to be private in Judaism, or more subtle, if you will. I mean, in Micha, we're told, Hatznei alachat im elokecha, you should walk humbly with God. Some people like to interpret that, you should be like, you know, reserved, silent, quiet. In Mishle, holich rachiyah megalasod, v'ne'man ruach v'chaseh davar, that someone who's faithful will conceal secrets, that sometimes is actually a good thing is to keep things private. Or in Pesachim, kuf yud bet amad aleph, Rabbi Akiva says that v'al tichanes lebeitcha pitom kol shekein lebeit chavercha. You know, like, before you enter your house, be sure to, like, knock first, basically, because, you know, sometimes people are doing private things in their houses and they just want a warning. Okay, so, like, let people be. Or in Bava Batra, Daf Samach Amud Aleph, or in Bava Batra, Bet Amud Beis, you have this idea of Hezek Re'iyah, that, you know, that there's a damage by seeing, that you shouldn't have the ability to look into somebody else's house. And then if a house is built in that way, that's actually halachically aser, because people need their privacy. Personally speaking, I think what we kind of get from these sources about privacy and confidentiality is that privacy has a place and a home for sure. That makes sense. The idea is Hezek Re'iyah, that your house should be private for only you and your family. Yeah, I get that. I think it's actually really amazing that Halacha talks about that. And in terms of transparency with Ahasuerus not telling his rationale, or maybe what Paro was really thinking when he said to Yosef, yeah, you should do it. Perhaps there are really good reasons why our political leaders don't explain everything. I'd only say, though, this following point, that sometimes people act differently if they know the whole story. And even if people have really good reasons to keep things private, sometimes it really makes sense, even if it's tough, to lay it all on the table. I'm not saying, you know, it's possible that really it worked out for the best this way. It's totally possible. I can't really say one way or the other. But I challenge you that the next time that you're in a situation where you think you're better off keeping it private, ask yourself, is it really better that way to have that information asymmetry? Is it really better that way? Would the person I'm speaking to think or act differently if they really knew the whole story? I think what we gather from here is that maybe it is worth it. It's not easy, but it might be worth it. And now for a round of questions. Go for it.
Honestly, I thought you were going to mention the pasuk in the pasuk in Megillah that says, "Ba'ir Shushan Avokah," that the city itself is utterly confused about what the heck is going on. I thought you were actually going to say that.
Okay, I like that. I like that. I like that.
It's like the people's reaction, right?
Yeah.
It's like, are they so in support of Ahasuerus' plan?
Yeah. Also, they're not taking. Can I just say something? They're not taking their king seriously because he sent out a decree that says all women should listen to their men. I mean, that was already a get-go in that community, in that country. It's like, okay, but why are you telling me to do something already now? Like, okay, your decrees are absolutely ridiculous. Like, what?
But how do you know that they thought that? Where's the people's response?
You never read the op-ed.